This episode is sponsored by our 7th Row members. The support of our members makes this podcast and everything else we do at 7th Row possible. To find out more about membership, go to 7th-row.com/join. That's SEVENTH-ROW.com/join. Welcome to the 7th Row Podcast, a weekly podcast in which we focus on under-the-radar, female-directed, and foreign films, and discuss how they engage with the world. I'm your host, Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of 7th Row. 7th Row is a nonprofit publishing house dedicated to helping viewers engage in political conversations through the lens of cinema. We're invested in how film can be a catalyst to help people understand and think about social structures and social change. Just a heads up that this podcast contains spoilers. We aim to make our conversations accessible, whether you've seen the film or not, but we will talk freely about a film's entire plot from the beginning of our conversation. So on today's episode, we'll be discussing Dominic Graf's Fabian Going to the Dogs, which premiered at the Berlinale in competition last year and is now streaming, at least in Canada and the US. It is a film adaptation of Eric Kastner's Fabian, the story of Fabian, the story of a moralist, about the rise of fascism in 1931 Germany. And the book was actually banned and burned by the Nazis and remained unavailable in print for decades until recently. So for this discussion, we have with us our executive editor, Orla Smith.
Hello.
And our very special guest, Andrew Kendall.
Hi.
So some related episodes to this one, I guess. What was our theme here is like, episodes about like
life under
totalitarian states. Yes. Life under totalitarian states. And well, we've picked an episode that we had Andrew on, which was our episode on Quo Vadis, Aida and Our Lady of the Nile, which was specifically genocide themed. And also episode 93, in which we covered Agnieszka Holland's career through mainly the lens of three films, Europa, Washington Square, and Charlatan. And I think one of the main themes we return to is that you can see in these three films and in basically her whole career, she has a really strong interest in portraying life under totalitarian regimes and how those regimes work and affect people, even in Washington Square, where that's like much patriarchy. More abstract. Yeah, it's much more abstract, but it's still clearly an interest. But she's also made like movies about literal totalitarian states, and Europa is also about like life under like the Nazis, which is what Fabian is about.
No, Fabian is set before the Nazis. It's 1931, right?
Yeah, it's not about life under the Nazis, but it's sort of about the rise of the Nazis.
Yeah.
And they are like a shadow looming over.
Yeah, yeah. They just haven't been elected yet, but they're there.
Yes. And so I think when I think about films about totalitarian states, I think about Agnieszka Holland first, because she has a very long career of interest in that very thing.
And she's made some of the best films about that period. Those episodes are more than 6 months old now, so that means they are only available to our members. To become a member, you can go to 7th-row.com/join, and then you will have access to not just those episodes, but our entire back catalog, as well as our bi-weekly members-only bonus episodes, which means you can hear us recently, I suppose, bash Benedict Cumberbatch. Actually, no, we tried to be nice to him. Bash Kenneth Branagh, bash the Coen Macbeth. We do sometimes do like nice things.
Our bonus are only when we want to be mean.
Well, like we did talk about Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing, which was all praise. So it's, you know, they're just sort of slightly less formal, I guess. Set in Berlin in 1931, Fabian Going to the Dogs follows Dr. Jakob Fabian, who works in advertising and spends his evenings enjoying the city's hedonistic pleasures as he awaits for the fall of Europe. We meet his best friend, Labud, a rich PhD student who is fighting for political change, And soon, Fabian meets Cornelia, who describes herself as an expert in international film law, but wants to be an actress. They fall in love, but when Fabian loses his job and can't find further work, love is too costly in these times. Cornelia becomes a kept woman for a film producer who will support her career, while trying to maintain a relationship with Fabian. Seeping in the frame throughout, we get glimpses of the rise of Nazism, the terror in the streets, and the overwhelming poverty of the Great Depression. Fabian, a moralist, spends his time observing and jotting things down in a notebook, which his friend Laboud hopes will become a novel, even though he notes Fabian's lack of ambition. But is there any room for a moralist in an increasingly amoral world? Here is the trailer.
Bisschen tiefer. Gut.
Lass sie fliegen.
Hinsichtlich ihrer Bewohner ist diese riesige Stadt aus Stein längst ein Irrenhaus.
Wie heißen?
Fabian, Jakob Fabian.
Bist du nicht ein bisschen dicker?
Im Osten residiert das Verbrechen, im Zentrum die Gaunerei, im Norden das Elend, im Westen die Unzucht.
Herr Dr. Fabian, wollen Sie sich wieder einschreiben bei uns?
Nie im Leben. Und in allen Himmelsrichtungen wohnt der Untergang.
Und was kommt nach dem Untergang?
In Bars und Tanzläden treiben Sie sich rum, weiß ich doch. Wir haben ja gar keinen Respekt vor dem Leben.
Nur für meinem eigenen nicht, das stimmt allerdings, ja.
It's a film about how PhD students can't find a job.
You know, it's like really depressingly accurate about what it's like being a PhD student. Like, it's PTSD kind of accurate. Okay, so the first thing with Fabian is it's just like a wild ride. It's a 3-hour period film that is incredibly formally inventive and fast and fun, and I don't think I've really seen anything like it, even though we'll talk a lot about other things that it reminds us of. But I think one of the things that's super striking to me about it is the way that it connects the past to the present, which of course every good period piece will do. But I think something that's been happening as a trend recently in a lot of period pieces, especially period pieces relating to like Nazism and totalitarian states, is there's a sort of timelessness in the construction of the costumes and the design, which kind of confronts you with how not in the distant past this is and how it is very much in the present. So like, although I would say they're wearing costumes that are absolutely make sense for the 1930s, they also wouldn't really be out of place in a contemporary world. And that is a lot like what like Transit is doing, what A Radiant Girl did, which we talked about on our Cannes 2021 episode. So I think there's some interesting trends going on in that. And of course, like, we in the world are experiencing the rise of like right-wing politics, and there's a war going on right now. So it just feels very like a very timely thing to talk about is, I guess, why I wanted to talk about it. But perhaps you guys have thoughts.
Yeah, I essentially agree with all that Alex says about the ways that the film is obviously quite politically apt right now, both in terms of films that are kind of engaging with, you know, the rise of evil politically, but also our present situation globally, which is very politically strained. And it's always interesting looking at filmmakers, because this is a film adaptation of a novel that is about 90 years old. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting watching a filmmaker from the same country as the writer of the text, kind of like looking back to their country's past. And of course, Germany is a quite politically fraught country. There's so much history to excavate. And I think beyond whether or not you find Fabian as a film engaging or not, it has that, I think, kind of like essential bit of, it's like an archaeological excavation in a way, because you kind of get the sense that the film is very like clearly engaging with what the present Germany has to do with the past of Germany. And there is that very, you know, compelling opening shot, which opens in the present day, going down the subway, and then we move into the past in a kind of a, it's not quite a fade in, but it's,
well, it's there, we're in the subway in the present day in Berlin, and then we walk up the stairs to the outside world, and suddenly there are like Nazi posters, and it's 1931.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, I mean, it's kind of like a boring metaphor, but it's really effective in the film, I think, yeah. Which is that, you mm-hmm. know, in the blink of an eye, you're in the past or in the future. And you wonder, how did you get from there to here?
Oh, I really like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that really resonates with that film you mentioned, Alex, A Radiant Girl, which we saw at Cannes last year. It's a film that, I mean, I suppose it's set a bit, it's set a bit later, but in the same kind of vague time period of, like, the Nazis are in power in that film.
Mm-hmm.
But and our main character is a young Jewish girl in Paris who is mostly focused on just her own coming of age and her, like, aspirations to be an actress. And in the background of the film, we sort of notice the small ways in which her life is starting to be restricted, but that because, like, she is so sort of focused on her life and, like, the freedoms that she wants to experience, when she notices that, like, things are really getting bad, it's kind of too late. And that film uses a lot of techniques, like costumes that are neutral enough that they could really look like they were from the present day or from the past. Like, they're kind of time period ambiguous, and there's a kind of, the performances feel quite modern. It does an intentional job of, like, blurring the lines between the past and the present in the way that the film looks. So I think it's trying to do something very, like, as a whole film, trying to do something very similar to, well, Fabian as a whole, and particularly that opening sequence. And I mean, I think that that's something that people are thinking about a lot right now, mm-hmm. is, like, how things that we learned in history class that happened 100 years ago and we were taught were really bad. We are seeing signs of those same kinds of things happening in the world now. And mm-hmm. how do we react to our presence being very close to the history that we, like, know is bad, mm-hmm. but not recognizing that in ourselves? And I think those two films are very intentionally trying to point that out. And I think it's A Transit is also doing that as mm-hmm. another example. And those are the three I can think of right now, yeah. but I think that is a trend.
And Transit is kind of more extreme in a way, because you see, like, modern cars. It is effectively set today in the sense of what the production design looks like and the places that they're in. There are modern buildings, but the events are very clearly tied to what happened in France under the Vichy state. And they make direct reference to historical events, but they never use the word Nazis. I think they just call them the fascists. And the main character, played by Franz Rogowski, we find out he was in a concentration camp and escaped, and now he's, like, trying to escape the Nazis who have just arrived in France. But we never find out, like, why he was in a concentration camp. We don't find out, is he Jewish? They don't actually even talk at all about Jews. All we know is that he doesn't have the right papers, and so he has to avoid being stopped and having his papers looked at while he's waiting to try and leave the country. So that was sort of like, and that was kind of controversial, that film, in a way. People were like, is it okay to tell a Holocaust story where you make it where it's not even set then? But it had, like, costumes that were of the 40s, but also not so stylized to the 40s that they couldn't fit today. And then these newer films are more like, no, we're definitely in the 30s or the 40s here, but we're going to kind of, at least contextually, and, you know, we aren't afraid to show, like, the Star of David armbands or whatever, but as in Radiant Girl, obviously Fabian is set too early for that, but they are definitely in conversation with that sort of new idea that I don't think was, you know, like, when, you know, or like you mentioned Europa, for example, when Europa was made, it was controversial to even suggest that Hitler and Stalin were alike, and that, you know, the regime of the communists in Russia was in some way akin to the fascists in Germany. And that was in the, it was like, what, 1990 when that was made?
1990, yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, that was a radical idea then. And now it's, like, even more confronting that we're not just saying, Hitler wasn't the only totalitarian regime, but we're saying actually there's a lot of similarities to the world right now.
And what I'm curious to know from the two of you who have read the book is that it's interesting that this book was, it's set before Hitler rose to power, but the film is sort of very much about like how that is looming mm-hmm. in the distance. But the book is written, it was written before Hitler rose to power in that time.
Yeah, it was published in 1932, and I mm-hmm. believe it was about 1931. So it's that same time. It's just like wild how prophetic it is.
I'm curious, like in the choices of adaptation, like the things in the film that are like very much flagging the rise of fascism, like how does the film and the book deal differently with that now that the film has the hindsight that the book didn't have?
I think that's one area that I'm not sure what word to use, intrigued, fascinated, like thinking about those dynamics, because obviously like you can't unring a bell, so it's hard to think about a text like this with our knowledge of the next decade in Germany without like having that bleed into how you think about the text. And I would assume how the writers and director and the actors engage with it. You know, it's hard to really kind of like remove that. It actually reminded me in a strange way though of Nella Larsen's Passing in a way. Because when I think of Nella Larsen's novel as kind of a book that seems almost preternaturally aware of the future in engaging with race. And when you read the text, it is really uncanny, like Arla says, to think that this is written before Hitler's rise, before the World War II begins, but there's so much nervous tension or energy sort of looming over it. And I think a good way of thinking of it in relation to contemporary work from that era is like 7 years after this book comes out, Christopher Isherwood writes Goodbye to Berlin, mm-hmm. which is now in the middle of, well, just about the beginning of World War II, which is obviously a lot more explicit about, you know, fascism rising again and the implications of that. So it's interesting, like, within just a 7-year period, how those two texts kind of engage with each other, but also how much Germany changed within that brief time, I think.
Well, and that book was what Cabaret is based on. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Was that a different book? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So,
well, Cabaret is based on the play. Based on, yeah, but it's, yeah, it's lineage.
But I mean, obviously, especially considering how much time, like, Fabian spends in nightclubs and like the amount of sex in it, that obviously it's hard not to think about Cabaret. And I guess what's sort of interesting if you think about the difference between those two texts in a way is like Cabaret is people who, well, I think generally the way it plays is it's people who are, you know, having a good time and trying to avoid what's going on in the outside world, and then they avoid it for so long that it's now inevitable. And in Fabian, it feels a lot more like he knows that they're coming. He, like in the book and in the movie, he talks about like, why not just go back home to Dresden to wait for the fall of Europe? And there's something really sad about like the going to nightclubs and the sort of reveling in the hedonism of the city. Like it's like a last hurrah because they know it won't be there forever. Which is not really the vibe. Like, I mean, Cabaret is depressing in other ways, but that's not really, it's not like you think the Cabaret is going to disappear. It's more about they're too busy at the Cabaret to be aware of what's going on. And in Fabian, it's like not possible to turn blinders onto it, even though he is like it's an interesting character because he's not really somebody who's going to be directly affected by what happens, right? Like, he's basically like an Aryan guy.
But he's still sort of like, as someone who is not rich,
yeah,
like, suffering in this society in the sense that he's lost his job and it's a capitalistic society where many people are suffering in various ways.
Right, and he's a moralist who doesn't want to sell his soul for money, let alone to like a totalitarian regime. But there's also like a sort of helplessness to it. Like Laboud is fighting and there's, you know, a question of whether Laboud's fight is futile, but Fabian's just kind of like sitting around waiting for it to happen. Just like he says, he's not doing anything to stop it either.
I guess it's kind of like a film about like these people who are just kind of helpless, and it's like, how do you act as a person in a society that you know is failing and that you don't have power to stop failing? And it's why like Laboud's end, Fabian's deaths at the end are just kind of absurdly funny, and how they feel kind of like meaningless. Like Fabian, before he dies, the narrator is like, oops, Fabian thought, as he like fell into the wall. And then we found out that Laboud died because of a practical joke. And it's like very sad, but also like, and tragic, but also very kind of funny. Everything was terrible anyway, and they were just these sort of pawns within like a society heading towards doom. And doesn't that feel relatable?
Yeah, I almost think that like Cabaret, for example, is almost more hopeful in the sense it's like, well, it happened because they were too busy. They had their nose in the cabaret, and if they took their nose out, maybe they could have stopped it. And Fabian's kind of like, nope, it's going to happen. There's nothing we can do because we can't even feed ourselves.
That's interesting, actually, because I was thinking one thing that I, that really sort of jumped out at me, like there's this bit in the film where Fabian is writing very early in his diary, and he has this line that I wrote down that I thought was so evocative. It says, stations came and went, yet the train racing across the years at its goal will never be. And I was thinking about that, like, symbolism of the train, especially because the film opens with the train station.
Yeah.
And thinking about how the kind of dichotomy between moving and inaction is sort of so critical, both to this film, but also just films about living in totalitarian regimes in a way. And so much of Fabian's kind of existence is this kind of like inertia.
Yeah.
Like even his final moment in the film, which is technically a moment of action, is in a way inaction at its very end. And I mean, I think like Fabian, Cabaret, all films, not all films, all books that are written about this, you know, leading up to World War II, like they kind of have the same element of desperation, but it's just like the desperation is outside of Fabian in a way. Like everybody else seems really anxious to do things.
Yeah.
And like make stuff. And Alex, like you mentioned in your notes on the film, that, you know, like he keeps talking about his book he's writing, but we don't ever actually see him really writing as the film goes on. So it's
I'm
like,
I'm not even sure he ever says he's writing a book. Laboud says he's writing a book.
Yeah, he doesn't, like, disagree, I don't know, with him.
Right.
Yeah, so it's like this weird thing where like everyone else on the outside of him is really propulsively doing stuff or thinking about doing stuff or talking about doing stuff, and but he's there and he just is. It's like the inertia of the future is so overwhelming that he is just like doomed to wait, which is in its own way a different kind of a tragedy. But I feel, for me, I also find it not that tragic though, because I feel like ultimately he seems like so, like, I don't want to say he's given up on life, but he seems like so ambivalent about anything.
Yeah.
So it's hard to feel a sense of like sadness or like overwhelming emotional pain for him, because he himself seems like so like lethargic in response to everything around him.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why his death is actually quite funny, where the narrator says oops, he thought, as he sank. And I you know, it's kind of depressing, but it's not really sad for him. That makes sense. It's like, yeah, just sad in the state of the world, that like there's nothing left for him.
Yeah, and it's, I guess, one big metaphor for the movie, like he jumps into the lake to save a boy who he thinks is drowning. So he's like, I guess this is like a good thing to do. And then he dies.
And the boy is fine.
Yeah. And it was all kind of meaningless.
I do find it annoying when like talking about adaptations, people like talk a lot about what the Original text is doing, but it's hard for me not to think of that moment in relation to the text itself, because I think I feel like the writing of that scene kind of sets up like a really major theme for the entire work in a way a lot more like effectively, because like the very last line of, well, two lines of the novel are, it says, little boy swam ashore howling, the boy that Fabian was trying to save, who can swim. And then it says, Fabian sank, unfortunately could not swim. And the novel just ends there. Like, it doesn't like say anything. It just sort of ends abruptly there. And I was thinking, it's hard not to like read like some kind of like metaphor into this, because one, he dies trying to save this little boy he thinks is dying in the river, but the boy is not dying in the river. And it's such a good example of how Fabian is completely unable to like read cultural cues in a way. he is so out of touch with what's happening around him. But also, like that final line, Fabian sank, unfortunately could not swim, because like he can't, like even if he didn't die in that moment, I feel like in a way he would have been doomed to just like waste away if he lived.
Yeah, because that's where he is at the beginning.
Yeah, he just doesn't have the I don't want to say strength to like make somebody die like a moralistic thing, but it's like, I don't even think that he wants to really, like there isn't any sense that he's struggling to stay alive even, you know. Yeah. And like it's a sense like, you know, this is the best outcome for him, because like he stays alive and what, he becomes a Nazi officer.
Or, I mean, I like the use of the word unfortunately. It's yeah. just sort of like, well, that was a shame. Moving on.
Yeah, it's sort of, and I guess my like instinctive response to the ending in both the film and the book is like, oh, that's such a waste. Which is really what the film is about and the book is about ultimately, which is that this is how a life comes to waste in a culture that doesn't really have space for people. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of sadder for me more because of like the themes more than because of like the actual characters.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, because you were talking before about the idea of whether or not you have any forward motion, and like even the other characters in the film, it's okay, Cornelia, I guess she moves forward in the sense that like they're out of money, so she decides she's going to move in with this rich film magnate and be his mistress and become a movie star, but she sells her soul to do it, and it's kind of a miserable experience and existence, even if she sort of gets something she wants out of it. And then you have Laboud, who kind of has the world at his feet in the sense that he's super rich, he's super bright, but he's taken down by an unfaithful girlfriend, and as Orla said, like a practical joke that one of his classmates plays on him, which, you know, it's like depressingly relatable that if you got a note in the mail supposedly from your advisor telling you that your thesis was a piece of shit and that you shouldn't defend it, or that they would save you the trouble of the embarrassment of defending it, it would probably make a lot of people suicidal.
Especially after how long it takes to complete a PhD.
Yeah, exactly. You have all your self-worth tied up in it. So, like, I mean, Laboud is more active in finding a way out, and that he dies by suicide. But he and Fabian are kind of set up as these sort of opposites, where Laboud has a lot of potential and also a lot of ambition. He's politically organizing and he has a lot of privilege. And Fabian has like none of these things. I mean, we don't really know, was he a good scholar or not? It seems like he's kind of, you know, like fine.
According to Laboud, he is a talented writer, but yeah. He doesn't do any writing.
Yeah, but Laboud also sees the world through rose-colored glasses, so
yes,
hard to know.
It is hard to know, and it's interesting. I watched the movie before I read the book. Yeah, it wasn't so much scrutiny that as I would have liked to have read it, but when I saw the movie, I was certain that the novel was going to be written in first person, and it wasn't, which I found really strange, because typically when you think of adaptations of novels, you kind of read books that tend to hew to the main character a lot closer than movies do. But weirdly, this time around, I felt like the film was like really bound up in Fabian's consciousness a lot more than the novel was.
Yeah.
Like even though the film is doing a lot of work in like signposting, like slot stickers and like what will become Nazi paraphernalia, I feel like tonally and mood wise, it's so in sync with Fabian's mood and headspace as opposed to the book, which I think is a lot more on the outside looking in. So it was an interesting contrast for me.
I mean, both of them are very episodic, but in the book, there's a lot more characters that Fabian meets who are kind of caricatures, so I can understand why they decided instead to just sort of beef up the characters at the center of it. But what you get from it is that it's not just like Cornelia, who has sold her soul, who's kind of the symbol of that in the film, where, you know, Laboud kills himself to get out of it, and Fabian like moves in with his parents, and who knows what would have happened if he hadn't sank. But in the book, like even from the very beginning, Fabian encounters a bunch of people who are living in this kind of perpetual stasis. Like he has a friend who's a newspaper editor, and they have this rather funny conversation about, you know, how they're printing what the chancellor said, and that they can't write something critical of the chancellor because then the government will get mad. And so Fabian's like, why not just write something in support of the government? And they're like, no, that would be horrible, and we're never going to do that. And they have this conversation about how they're basically printing kind of fake news, but like, you got to eat, so we're going to do it. And then he meets this inventor guy who made a fortune inventing things, and now he is like an itinerant who has no home, and at one point camps out on Fabian's couch, and he's sort of already been destroyed by the times. And so you see this like time and time again, that like you have a world, like everybody in the world is corrupt, and then Fabian doesn't want to be corrupted, but then what's left for him in this world? I think that's maybe a bit stronger in the book than in the film, where it kind of relies a bit more heavily on the corruption that relates to the women, like Frau Moll, who we should talk about at some point, who opens this like brothel for women, brothel of men for women, and tries to give Fabian a job, and like all of these encounters that he has with like women who have to sell themselves and or their bodies is more what we see than about like just the selling of your soul and regular jobs that men also do.
Yeah, I definitely agree there on the quality in the novel of very much being Fabian at the center of this like white composite of different characters that we meet sometimes very briefly, as opposed to the film, which is really kind of structures the romance in a way with sort of like his friend Laboud and like a third party to that. I do think, like, to my point about the way that the film seems to use so closely to his consciousness, one for me limitation that I found in the film is that it's a film about, you know, the underbelly of poor Germany in the early 1930s, you know. Yeah. So it's like there's talk of, you know, the seediness, and like we do get some glimpses of it. But what I found really odd in watching the film was how rarely it felt like angry or like nasty or even like off, but like it felt too easy to watch considering what it was about in a way. It's a very aesthetically creative film. Like it's doing a lot of like, I don't know, kind of postmodern stuff and like playing around with cross-cutting and like two scenes at the same time, and like there's like some really interesting stuff with narration happening, which I'm always like interested in seeing how filmmakers use narration in movies. Mm-hmm. And this one does it really in some really amusing ways. But I just found like, it could have been, like, dirtier. Like, there's a line where one of the characters says, you know, the only way to get out of mud is to, you know, get muddy.
Yeah.
But it never really feels rough. Like, I was expecting, like, a 2021 film about the 1930s look like. I kept waiting. Like, even with the full frontal nudity in the film, it felt weirdly calm, which I think is the film doing Fabian's perspective more than an outside perspective. So Fabian is so, like, I think, kind of innervated to the world around him. Nothing really, like, stuns him or, like, surprises him. Like, he just, like, goes along. He never seems like he is, like, startled by anything in life. And I think the film kind of takes on that consciousness, which ends up kind of making it feel weirdly sanguine for me throughout, which I just found really strange.
I don't know if I wholly agree with... I think you're right that Fabian's not stunned, but, I mean, the way the film, like, the opening story of the film, which is also in the book, is Fabian goes to this, like, club to meet people who want to hook up. And he gets picked up by this older woman, Frau Moll, who takes him home and is, like, really intense about wanting to have sex with him. And then they get interrupted by her husband, who informs Fabian that, like, yeah, he couldn't keep up with his wife's sexual needs, but now he has full approval of his wife's sexual partners. And if Fabian could please just come over and sign this contract. And we get into this, like, really absurd thing where, like, you can see in the background, Frau Moll is, like, humping the chair, waiting for Fabian to come back and service her. And the husband is, like, negotiating calmly with Fabian about this tryst. And Fabian goes, you people are nuts and I'm leaving. And that whole thing is kind of...
amusingly absurd.
Amusing and absurd, yeah. And Fabian, you get the sense of he just kind of, like, goes along with it. Like, eventually he decides it's too much for him, and he leaves. But you don't really feel like this was that anomalous of an experience in Fabian's life, especially when you see, like, you know, he goes to the place that is at an art school, or is it a brothel, or is it both? And you get the sense that he regularly enters these spaces, and he's just sort of, I don't know, like, almost anthropological about it, like, interested in observing, and so nothing catches him by surprise, and his outlook is already so gloomy, like, I'm just waiting for the fall of Europe, that he's just kind of, like, hoping to be amused. So I guess, I don't know that it needed to be, like, as dark as, say, you know, like, Sam Mendes' Cabaret is.
Well, which is true. I mean, like, it wasn't... I'm happy it wasn't darker, to be honest. Yeah. But I think I just would have liked to be excited by the world. Like to understand his own attraction to it. I never really got it visually looking at him. Like why is he compelled by the people around him? Like even the love story that's set up is this great love story, because, like, the narrator announces twice that he's about to meet the woman who's going to change his life, and he meets her, Cornelia, and, like, I mean, she's fine. But I never, like, I don't want to bring up Cabaret again, but it's like that energy of waiting for when Sally Bowles comes on, and it's like, okay, that's Sally Bowles. I understand why he's fascinated by her. Because they are kind of similar in a way. Like, Fabian is, in a way, like a camera watching everything around him, which is the same as the protagonist in Cabaret, who's just, like, watching and not really partaking. But, like, I understand the excitement in that I like, Fabian just seems so... He seems like someone I didn't expect to, like, really fall in love that hard. So even when it happens, I'm like, is he really in love with her, or is he just going through the motions because that's what he feels like he should be doing?
Yeah, I think maybe where I agree with you, or what you're getting at maybe, is, like, he's kind of a frustrating character, and this maybe goes to the difference between the third person narration and hewing to his perspective in the film. Like, what Fabian really thinks doesn't super matter in the book, because it's more about the world he's encountering. and the people around him. So whether he has great ambitions or not, or strong feelings, or, you know, he's just kind of like the wanderer through which we see the world. But you're right that the film is much more invested in his perspective. But I don't know that it always, like, I still don't necessarily know that I get who he is, even though I think Tom Schilling, who plays Fabian, is really wonderful and does try and give him, like, a depth that is maybe not there in the text. But, like, maybe it's partly because he's an ambivalent sort of figure. Like, he knows what's going on, but he's not going to do anything about it. But also, he's not, doesn't have the power to do anything about it. And who won't make difficult choices because he doesn't like the outcomes of them. So there's, like, he sort of has, like, a shelf life as a character, I guess. Whereas, you know, if we had followed Cornelia, we would at least keep encountering difficult moral choices. But Fabian's choice of, like, constant indecision, like, oh, well, I guess I just won't have a job. Oh, well, I guess now my girlfriend's gone. Oh, well, like, my best friend is dead. I guess I don't have any money, so I'll go live with my parents. Like, he just is very reactive, I guess. Are passive. And not that a passive character can't be interesting, but they do kind of have to have something that they're trying to work through. I don't know that Fabian is really trying to work through anything. He's kind of like has a fixed state view of the world, and maybe that kind of gets shaken up a bit by falling in love with Cornelia, more so in the movie, I think, than in the book.
Like, I think I said earlier on, like, I'm not the biggest fan of the film as a film, but I do find it interesting, and, like, there's so much to talk about.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I think it is ultimately unhelpful to think about films in terms of, like, you know, good or bad, do I like them or not, because, and instead to think about them in terms of, you know, what they offer us in terms of conversation. And
yeah.
There's so much going on here to think about that I think really works ultimately as a kind of like a sociological text. Like, it's obviously a film that's doing things intentionally, making, like, you know, specific choices and trying to work through stuff that I think is ultimately more vital for film as, you know, art than a nice film that just really doesn't really have anything to really say.
What I think is kind of interesting about Fabian, the book and the film, is, like, going back to the book, I'm like, wow, the film has really captured the spirit of the novel. And yet, having read the book, I never personally would have imagined a film like this, which to me is kind of fascinating. I think a lot of film adaptations, you see them and you're kind of like, yeah, I can see, like, this seems like my vision of the book and this feels like a reasonable adaptation. But, like, I never would have thought, oh, yeah, let's adapt Fabian with, like, all these weird zooms and flash forwards and flashbacks and two narrators and Super 8 footage. Like, that's not something that, like, reading it is obvious. I mean, because those are modern ideas, of course, right? So you're not going to get them from the book. But at the same time, I feel like actually that's a really thoughtful, formal way of bringing the kind of fast-paced sort of episodic nature of it. And the fact that it's 3 hours long lets you kind of really deal with a lot of these little episodes, even if there are fewer of them in the film, so that you still feel like you're entering a world to a degree that I think is really hard to do. And, like, I agree with you. I think I like the movie more than you do, but there are also things about it that don't work for me. But ultimately, I think it's such an interesting engagement that to me, it's basically what you said.
And I really do want to stress, though, because the value in, like, watching a film like this, which is so clearly very passionate about what it's doing. There's a really good interview with Dominic Graff on the film stage where he talks about conceptualizing the film, and, like, he read the book for the first time, I think, in 1970 something. Mm-hmm. So, like, this has been, like, on his mind for a very long time, and I feel like you watch a work like this and it's very clearly, like, well thought out. It isn't a sense of, like, a cursory adaptation, which I think is why Alex can say, you know, it captures the spirit of the novel, but it's also not what you'd expect if you read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not like somebody read the book today and just, like, said, okay, I'll make a movie tomorrow with the book, like, heavily. It's clearly, like, he lives with this book and, like, had a sense of how he sees it.
Yeah.
And like it's like his interpretation, which is really what a compelling adaptation does.
Yeah.
It's Dominique Graff, Fabian, writ large.
Yeah. And yeah, to that point, you could easily make another film that would be completely different and also be a good adaptation. Because it's so specific.
I guess I wasn't surprised, though, to see that he has done a lot of work in TV before, though.
Yeah.
And not as dismissive thing, because I like TV.
No.
But there's a patience and I think a lack of brevity in his approach to...
It's a very diplomatic way.
Yes, it's very much a sort of like, you know, this is somebody who isn't like caught up in like the anxiety of like making things quick for film.
I mean, I would have said the same thing, but from the opposite point of view, like, because when you see like, this is a 3-hour period piece about like 1931 Germany, if you're like me, you see that and you go, oh my God, this sounds boring and slow and depressing, and I don't know that I want to watch this. And of course, I would say it's none of those things, that it kind of has the fast pace and energy of TV and the ability to be episodic and to not dwell forever because you have to get everything into your 40-minute runtime or whatever. And so it kind of has the virtues of TV, but inside a film. Like, obviously, you could see this being made as a miniseries. But I kind of like that it's a film instead. I mean, it's kind of the same length, but the not having there be distinct episode structure, the way that it can all sort of like you, the way it loops back on itself is kind of unexpected. It's not like, well, we're in episode 1, so here's Frau Moll, and now we're in episode 2, so Frau Moll is back. It's like you never know when she's going to show up, and she keeps showing up again.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think that it's most visually interesting in those first 40 minutes. And I think probably because the film kind of settles into its own like idea of what it wants to be, like by the time the 1-hour mark hits, and it sort of becomes mostly about the romance for a good stretch of it. Your mention of
Frau Moll.
Yes. She's kind of like, if this were a series, she'd be like that guest character that pops up, but sort of like that you keep waiting for. You know, like you know, like she's, I don't know, like is she like his Moriarty? Because she has this energy, and I mean the actress who plays her, I think, is probably my favorite actor in the movie. Probably she's just really engaging on screen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like every time she pops up, I'm like, okay, yeah, there she is again. It's such a sharp idea of that character that just like gets just really like gets to, you know, this kind of like malaise, but also she's not like hopeless, and she's also like, she's also kind of, I guess, unethical, but she's also like not seedy. But and, yeah. Like, she's kind of glamorous, but she's also kind of like weirdly kind of repulsive in a way. It's and just sad. Like she's doing all of these mm-hmm. like really interesting things, and like there's a scene where she's wearing this really it's like a burgundy kind of like coat. It looks kind of silk, but it's probably not silk, because that seems like it would be impossible. But like she just has this like really like striking way of like looking on screen. It works. I kept thinking of like actors she reminded me of. Like I was thinking like Christine Baranski in a way, but also like Kristin Scott Thomas in a way, like Martin Dietrich in a way. Like she just has this like real presence that really works in the film.
I should say it's Merritt Becker.
Yes, I should have called the actor's name Merritt Becker.
I did want to ask about like what you think about how the signs of the times kind of seep into the frame. I guess at the end there's sort of like an encounter with a Nazi boy at the university, but not in any, like, it's more you see stuff happening on the periphery and, or you hear stuff happening and Fabian's aware of it, but it's not necessarily directly affecting any of his friends or family. But we're, I think, always aware that this is something that's going on in the background. And I don't think a lot of films are very good at doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of like that it doesn't lean on it harder than it does, because it would feel so untrue to the fact that the novel was, you know, it was written in that time and noticing the climate of the world, but it wasn't about like, and we know this is going to happen in a couple years' time. Mm-hmm. So it's attuned to the fact that like societies don't fall into disarray because one evil person got elected and then did evil. It's like the society has to be in a place where it can elect that person and be susceptible to that evil. And it's about that atmosphere more than it is about the Nazis were bad.
Yeah.
I do appreciate the restraint from Dominic Graf and his co-writer Constantine Lieb, because like Artis says, they don't make it too heavy-handed. Like, you know, there's some swastikas around and like there is other like bit of foreshadowing, but it's not like in a way that becomes too, you know, wink, wink, this is about to happen. It's all just very kind of like natural and restrained, which of course is in keeping with the film being in Fabian's perspective, who is similarly restrained and not particularly like, you know, propulsive or whatnot.
I mean, there's a bit more, like there's some rallying about like Germany, wake up with the Nazis. We just don't see them. They're outside his window and his mother, and he look out the window and we can hear it. And when he goes out to dinner with his mother, there's some guy who gets like dragged away by a group of Nazis to get like beaten up or something. We don't really know what happens, but there's definitely like some more stuff than just the swastikas. But I definitely agree with you. I'm curious because, of course, I was watching this. I mean, we are obviously in the middle of writing our book on Joachim Trier's films. Seems like a weird thing to bring in, but And I mean,
yes, you know, Joachim Trier, the filmmaker who makes films about totalitarian states.
Well, I guess the reason I was thinking about it is because it, in a way, it reminds me of Reprise and the way that it's playing with all these different formal elements like flashbacks and the way it's cutting and, you know, this wide cast of characters and the voiceover and all of these different things, which is what Andrew's essay is about in the book. And then it's sort of interesting to me that, like, there is a film about, and, you know, people who are sort of ambivalent or with indecision. I think they're a bit more ambitious than Fabian is, but they definitely share some characteristics with him. But that's a film that's sort of, like, devoid of political context. It's sort of like everything is fine and we're just sort of making our choices for ourselves, as hard as that may be. And I think one of the things that I like about Fabian is, I don't necessarily think that's like a bad thing. Like, that's hard enough to, like, I think it's worth, you know, zooming in and sorting that stuff out in a way that doesn't get done very often. But one thing I do like about Fabian is that it's very attentive to the minutiae of Fabian's life that don't have to do with, like, his ambitions. Like, we're always aware of how much things cost and how little money he has. And, you know, like when he loses his job, we find out exactly how much money he gets paid. And we already know what his rent is. And then when he goes and he buys something, we find out how much that is. So we're like, we're very aware of how Fabian's choices are completely defined by the political situation of the world around him, even if he's not directly encountering, like, he's not going to political rallies or he's not, like, you know, directly encountering Nazis, more or less.
That's an interesting parallel that I hadn't, like, previously thought about. It is playing around a lot with formal stuff. Like, not formal stuff. It's obviously being very kind of, I guess, ambitious. And that was a word that I wrote down in my notes as I was watching it. Even when it didn't always work, it was doing a lot of things that I think, especially in that first 40 minutes, because I was saying I kind of found the first 40 minutes more engaging. It definitely was keeping the spirit of the episodic structure of the novel, in a way. Like, it kind of refused to settle, which, of course, I think would have been a bit tedious if it kept doing that for 3 hours. So, fair point on that. But it did make me think, I think I mentioned this before we began recording, of a movie that I like a lot that is not much liked, but it's another film adaptation of a major novel, which is Tony Richardson's adaptation of Henry Fielding's Tom Jones, which is a novel about a rascally young man that's sort of like living in the world. I love that
going
movie.
On adventures.
It sounds very well liked, but it's a film that I think captures what you were talking about, though, in like the formal inventiveness, because that's a period film that looks really strange, especially for the time, 1963. Yeah. So like there are a lot of scenes where it's shot like a 1960s action movie, not like a 1960s period piece. And like there's like the hunting scene that looks really unlike a period piece of that era. And it's that same sense with Fabian, where they're doing a lot of stuff that you're like, okay, this is not what I expect this movie to look like. Like, especially like this is happening. Like even when there are the flashbacks or like in the club sequences, or like there's a scene where, well, when his friend is, well, not murdered, he kills himself, and they go to the scene, and then there are this like ring of prostitutes in the building, which is, it makes sense when you see it. Like, it's hard to explain that scene to someone without,
because there's
like
a lot of other stuff that happens along the way.
Yeah,
like why the prostitutes are just like, oh, he died and there happened to be prostitutes. So there's like a whole bunch of episodes that involve those particular prostitutes. And
it's definitely a you had to be there moment. But like watching the film sort of like just do really weird stuff, but not in like kind of a way to like show off, just like the sense that the only way to do this film in this time is by not thinking of it like a period film. And it reminds me of I remember this, like, you know, like Hollywood Reporter would have these round tables every award season, and one of my favorites is the one from 2010 with like Natalie Portman and Annette Bening and Nicole Kidman, and they were talking about like acting in period films, and like Natalie Portman and Annette Bening were like commiserating about working with Milos Forman, and when they were acting with him, because like I think Portman did Gaia's Ghost and Bening did Valmont, I think it was, and the way he would like scold them for like acting too periody in his movies, he'd be like, don't hold the cup like that, don't walk like that, it's just a regular movie, like pick it up normal, why are you moving like that? I also remember that, and it just makes me laugh that would like, and Annette Bening was like, you know, because that was very early in her career, she was like, you know, that really like taught me not to carry myself in a weird way because I'm in a period costume, you know? I'm still a normal person. I'm still, like, doing regular people stuff. And it's that same sense here where, like, yes, it's a movie set in 1930s, but it's also, it's not trying to, like, be glossy or, like, you know, ornate. It's just people being really weird, and the camera meets them at that weird level and does really weird stuff and, like, does weird intercutting stuff. And you're like, it's not what you expect, but it makes sense for this world with these people, with these characters, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that's why it's so effective too, because you feel like you're seeing a world that you recognize, and not just like a world that's stuck in the past that could never happen again. But you're right, it's that spirit throughout the entire film, because they don't carry themselves in the way that you would in that time period. They carry themselves in a very modern way.
Yeah, they're not precious about the past. It's just,
yeah, because it's not about being period accurate in every way. It's sort of like evoking the period, but making it feel like today.
Yeah, which I think is a good way to go about doing it.
Yeah, especially when it's not a film that's like about the manners of the period. Like, obviously, there are films where I don't think you could do The Age of Innocence, where people are just like lounging about the way they are today, because it's kind of like the film is about those period constraints. But in this sense, why there's no, it's not necessary to tell the story, and perhaps would cause too much distance. I mean, something Jacqueline Duran has talked about when I talked to her about designing the costumes for Peter Lou in our ebook on Peter Lou and Mike Lee, Peter Lou in Process, a Mike Lee collaboration, mikeleebook.com.
Well done.
but something she talked about when she was talking about period costumes is that you have to create something that is translatable to today. So I think one of the examples she gave was like, if we can, today we associate people who wear glasses with being bookish. So you might give a bookish character glasses, but if it's set in the 1700s, they didn't necessarily associate glasses with bookishness back then, right? It had different connotations. So it's not really period accurate to do that, but it tells you something about the characters today. And so whenever you're dealing with period stories, there's always this act of translation from what was perhaps, you know, specifically accurate to what is understandable and translatable to today. Because you could also have, you know, like, I actually just reading this book about, you know, very timely, about the difference between genocide and crimes against humanity, called East-West Street. And one of the things it talks about in it is that one way that people showed that they were Nazi sympathizers was to wear these white socks that went up to their knees. But, like, if you put that in this movie, no one would get it, right? Like, you would have to know that, and most people don't know that. So it's not very helpful for telling your story, even if it's period accurate.
Mm-hmm. I think when people make period pieces, they often don't think about what the accuracy is serving. And I think often there is like a real point to period accuracy. And I think to a certain extent, you do need a level of period accuracy, because people can sense when you've not put any effort into the sets, for example. But I always appreciate a film that has thought really hard about what elements of the period are really important to communicate, and knows what's important and what is less important, in the way that you've said. And I don't think necessarily, I mean, I'd say like most of the films that like win Oscars for period costume and production design aren't the ones that have thought the most carefully about what elements of the period are really important to convey. They were just wanted to be period accurate.
I think sometimes that's invisible, like the things that you've done. Like if you've done a good job, it's actually invisible. I'm thinking about, okay, just to like completely promote all of our books and the interviews that I've done. But when I talked to the sound designer, Kelly Reichardt's sound designer, Leslie Schatz, about Meek's Cutoff, he was talking about how when they shot the film, there were all these sounds of really loud sounds of planes overhead. And she would call him every day, like, what the hell are we going to do? I can't have the sounds of planes in my film from, you know, set in the 1800s. But, you know, that's a lot of work for the filmmakers to then fix the sound and cut out those planes. But as an audience member, I would not have known that, or that their attention to period detail was about making sure you didn't have something that was a complete anachronism in the sound, as opposed to, like, are the bonnets right?
It's interesting you mentioned Jacqueline Duren, because I wrote, like, explicitly down something about her when I was watching this.
Oh, really?
Well, it was about her, so, and great. Also, I think it's Sarah Greenwood, is it? The production designer that works with her and Joe Wright, usually.
Yeah.
Because there is a bit in it that made me think of Anna Karenina specifically, and I love Joe Wright's Anna Karenina. It's one of my favorite literary adaptations of the last decade. And there's scene in Fabian where Fabian is looking at Cornelia auditioning for a role with some lines that he wrote for her, although she says she wrote the lines in the movie. And like, she's on the stage and he's watching her from the wings above, and he walks off, and it's a weird moment, because like, logically, I'm not really sure he's actually there, because it wouldn't make any sense for him to be there in that moment. And it reminds me of the three things in Anna Karenina, the Joe Wright film. One is, so that film, if you've seen it, uses this conceit of the rich high society people being on a stage. And
A literal stage that you can see, the whole set. Whole film is set on this stage.
And then there's a moment in it where Donald Gleason's Constantine like leaves the life of tussle and bustle, and he goes off back to his, you know, humble living, and he literally leaves the stage. He just like leaves, he opens the door and he goes off stage. And there's a scene in it where Constantine is looking at Kitty, who's sort of like his love, but who is in a world different from him, and he is watching her above from the wings, just like it's happening in Fabian. It made me think of that. And I was thinking also, because I like Jacqueline Duren's work very much. I think she's a really, really thoughtful costume designer. I like hearing her talk about her work. She's just like so specific about stuff. Yeah. I was thinking about the way that she I mean, of course, the working on the ground is a lot more like ornate and like pretty, but like, like, you know, like she has stuff like, you know, she'll use denim in a weird way, or she'll use like, you know, unconventional materials, and there's that sense on a smaller scale, but similar in Fabian, where like you're seeing the ways that they're kind of interpolating like contemporary like designs and stuff in the set designs, in the costume, that's really kind of like playing around with like truth and illusion in a way. So like I wrote a bit about Anna Karenina because that's one of the films that I thought about watching this in a really strange way.
Yeah, and Fabian does a lot of showing us like Art Deco architecture, which of course is something we still, and we don't make anew, but we still have lots of buildings and designs like that that are still venerable today. So when you see them in the 1930s, it doesn't feel so distant from us. Like it feels like, yeah, that would be something that these characters are into, and they would be into it today, even though it's also of the time.
And I guess while we're on the topic of films that it made me think about, I think the one I really want to like really talk about is Pietro Marcello's Martin Eden.
Oh God.
Which is a film that I like a lot.
Can't stand it.
Which is kind of different from Fabian though, because like that's an Italian adaptation of a novel by Jack London that's set in like a really ambiguous time. Like it's there's no certainty as to when it's happening actually. It's sometime in the mid century. 20th century, but who knows when. But I think about that adaptation a lot because like
I can see what you mean.
Even though I know, because he's a sailor that becomes a budding writer, and like it's like the rise and fall of a hopeful young man in a somewhat burgeoning fascistic society.
He's also like a real specimen of like conventional male virility, kind of, you know, he's like this strapping young, I don't really know how to, like, you know, he's like, he's muscular and big.
He's hot, like, as fuck. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Tom Schilling is beautiful, but that's a better description of him, is that he's beautiful, you know, like he's lanky. He's not like,
it's hard. There's a difference between being hot and being good looking.
Well, and okay, well,
like one depends on fire burning, and one is like, you know, a nice winter night.
Okay, well, yeah, okay, sure, but that's not what I meant.
I support you,
Tom Schilling stands. I'm very sorry. I'm really not, actually.
Right. Okay. My point, though, is that with Tom Schilling, you see him, and when they're like, "Yeah, he has a weak heart from the war," you see Tom Schilling, and you're like, "Yeah, I can see that." Whereas
I don't like, that's the idea of how Tom Schilling looks, is he looks like he has a weak heart from the war.
I mean, I think he's great, really good looking. And I'm not very, like, I think I would say the same about the Martin Eden guy. What's his name?
Luca Marinelli.
Right. I don't think he's hot either. I just think he's like pleasing. But
does he look like he has a weak heart from the
No, world? But he looks like he works on a ship, right? He has like muscles. So he's sort of like anyway, my point was he's a little bit more of a conventionally masculine hero, which fits into, I mean, what I hate about Martin Eden is I find it reprehensibly chauvinistic. Which was, you know, semi excusable at the time it was written, but not excusable if you're going to do it today and set it in an ambiguous time period.
That's interesting. I've actually found Fabian a lot, not more, but I found it like equally weak on women.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, okay, I don't think it's equally weak as
I feel like in Martin Eden's case, like Martin Eden is an asshole, so it's like. Like, I mean, I really like the movie, but he isn't, it's his character ultimately, like, losing his way in life. And, like, in Fabian, like, it's weird because I feel like the film never really, like, comments on it. But I don't know, it's interesting. Like, it was Martin Eden and another movie I saw when I saw Martin Eden, which might sound like a really strange film to bring up, but Not of Lapid Synonyms.
Okay.
They're also about, like, sort of, like, just like young men at this age in life when you like sort of their lives are like ahead of them, you know, like they're in their late 20s, early 30s, and like there's this like drive of possibility. But like each of those men in those three films, they kind of just like find themselves hitting a wall literally in the case of synonyms, and like they just sort of like find themselves like swept up in the world they're living in. Like in the case of synonyms, it's an immigrant, Israeli immigrant in France, and in the case of Fabian, he is German and in Germany, but there's still that sense like ultimately the culture of a place completely just like overwhelms you to a sense that you just become submerged in it, which is sort of like the drowning metaphor at the end, which incidentally Martin Eden also ends with him going into the water. So like, I mean, something about men drowning in their very stressful lives perhaps. But like it's interesting like watching these very different films, like, you know, they're different languages, they're doing different kind of things in a way, but like they're about this kind of malaise of, I guess, contemporary masculinity, but also about like historical masculinity in a way that makes me think like there's something to be written about that, I think. Like how these films that are not like inherently similar feel like they're kind of like discussing the same state. And I think to go all the way back to Alex's opening as to why she like programmed this particular podcast, like we're talking about like how we're seeing the seeds of fascism alive today, but we're also seeing the, you know, complicity of patriarchal structures and men, even maybe nice men who are ambivalent about like action and like, you know, talk a good talk but don't really actually do anything. And it's not that they're like evil people, but it's the sense of, you know, we're all complicit, we're all involved, and ultimately if our view of the world is so skewed like Fabian's is, we might think we're about to save a little boy, but we're really just like not doing anything of substance.
Yeah, I think to your point, the problem with Fabian in the film is that he is complicit in the patriarchal structures and is not aware of it, and it's kind of gross, and the film isn't aware of it because he's supposed to be kind of like a decent guy. I think Fabian becomes a bit less reprehensible in some ways because I think the women are more developed than in Martin Eden. And like, you know, like you said, Frau Moll is a breath of fresh air in a bizarre, you know, like their entire arcs aren't just like, how can Fabian say things to me? And how can I be a springboard and a mirror and have no desires of my own, which is anyway, but I agree that the film is kind of silent about his complicity in that, and in that way I guess it feels like depressingly contemporary, but not necessarily in the way that it's intending to be.
Yeah, I think one thing that I don't like have a really like incisive point to make. I just written a note as it was happening that I only like recognize two moments in the film where like he really loses his temper, and one is when his friend dies and he learns that he died because of a practical joke essentially, and the other is when he's waiting for a phone call and his mother answers the phone and he just like flips out on her. And it's interesting for, I mean, you can probably take this point further, but like the thing that occurred to me is, one, it's interesting that both of his moments of like really passionate anger are not tied to himself in any way, really.
Mm.
But also that there's more harm happening to people around him, like, for example, his girlfriend. And like he seems like so like stultified by it all, like to the sense of like inertia that I found really interesting. So it's almost as if he's so overwhelmed by this sense of inactivity that it's the strangest moments that make him upset. It's not that he's upset that his friend has died, because when he finds him, he doesn't really have this like passionate response of grief either. Like he's sad, but it's not like anything like heartrending.
He's not weeping.
Yeah, but it's that little bit where he like loses on the guy who like made the unfortunate joke that really kind of like sets him off that I found really interesting.
I mean, maybe because it's like an injustice he feels like should have been fixed, that like it's a thing that shouldn't have happened, whereas other things are
inevitable,
more inevitable, like this is like, this definitely shouldn't have happened. And I guess the same with the phone, like his parents could have just not answered the phone. He asked them not to answer it before, and then they answered it, and they screwed up this one thing that he had some control over.
I mean, It did take me back to, I mean, I don't think, do people still have landline phones as much? But I mean, to be fair, in his defense, I mean, who has not been a teenager in the early aughts and been really annoyed when their parents would answer the phone when, you know, somebody's calling you and you don't want them to know? So, I mean, you know, as the youth say, felt.
But you're right, it's over, it's not over the rise of Nazism or like the guy getting beaten up or something like that. It's over these
things he feels like he should be able to control.
Yeah.
Rather than like the big things that are really terrible that like are just inevitable.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is, I mean, like, I keep saying like I like the ideas of it more than the movie, but like that really is a moving sentiment though. Like recognizing, especially I think for a film about a male character, to Alex's point about, you know, like, you know, the way the idea of virility is like a dominating characteristic in male characters on film and whatnot. And he's obviously not that kind of a male character. And there's obviously like the film doesn't like take great pains to like mourn that. Like, it's not a sense where like we see him like saying, you know, I wish I was more macho or whatnot, but I think there's that undertone. there's sort of like that listless undertone where he kind of recognizes that he isn't where he wants to be, that we can kind of read into it, I think.
I don't know. I mean, the flip side of that is I think he moves in a world where that particular, I was gonna say skill, it's not really a skill, like that particular quality of masculinity is not really helpful or valuable. Like, you know, if you're gonna work on a ship, you have to have muscles, but if you're gonna be like a copy editor, you can be a delicate boy.
But I guess it's more in the sense of watching where he kind of like tries to like shed that delicacy but poorly. And I just remember there is a third moment where he does kind of like lose it briefly, which is when he's in the cab with his girlfriend after they've they haven't reunited, but like the driver is driving and he's worried that the driver is listening to them and he kind of loses it on the driver. And again, like the driver is not the person with the power there. Like, the driver's working for Cornelia's new guy, I guess, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like he's able to like, you know, angrily ask the driver, can you read lips? Like, are you listening to us? But he wouldn't do that to the actual person that's the actual focus of his anger. And I think it's that kind of like recurring powerlessness that he has, that he can only choose. Like, he's not angry with his mother. I mean, if she answers the phone, ultimately, it doesn't really matter. But like, he's angry at the fact that, you know, his life has no direction. He has, you know, no prospects. He's alone. And it's like, there's this line in the film where it's like, being unemployed is normal these days. And it's like such a bleak outlook on the world that he's sort of just like given himself over to. And that's kind of sad. Not kind of, it's sad. It's very sad.
I mean, the other time that he gets angry but in a sort of subdued way is when, like, after they've gone out to dinner with his mother and then Cornelia's gone off with the producer and he starts to put together that this is not a new thing but it has been a plan that's been hatching for weeks. And she didn't tell him about it. And he gets, like, I don't know that he flips out in the way that he does in the other scenes, but he doesn't say anything for quite some time until they're alone together at home. He's very kind of, looks kind of unhappy and maybe a bit angry, but he doesn't act on it until they're alone together and he explains to her that he's put together the pieces and he's really upset that she's lied to him.
Is that the moment? I can't remember it because it's, the linearity is in my head in such a weird way, but I'm trying to remember that at the moment where she's like, well, you don't have a job, though.
Yeah,
And I was like, well, she has a point.
Yeah.
You don't have a job.
Well, and that's one of the things I really like about the film is it's very realistic about these things. Like, it's quite depressing in the choices they have, but it is like, okay, they sold everything they have. They're about to sell their record player. So she does kind of have to do something if he's not going to do anything. He keeps saying no to every opportunity that he gets because he doesn't like the moral implications of it. And
like you said earlier, like, the film allows you to keep close track of like exactly how much money Fabian has.
Yeah.
And what his expenses are, which did not appreciate being made to do very stressful budgeting while watching a film, as well as in my real life. But it really makes sort of the realities of like the practicalities of his life, especially as an unemployed person, very, very real.
And then when he becomes spendthrifty, you're like, why did you buy that dress, Fabian? And then his mother is also like, why did you buy that dress, Fabian? And you just know it's going to come back to bite him, and it does.
Because she even asked him, did you steal the dress? And he's like, no, I bought it, I haven't paid the rent. And I mean, that's a very stupid decision. I mean, it's not, it wasn't even that nice of a dress. And so it's, but I mean, you know, impulse buying is something that momentarily makes you feel happier with life. So understandable.
Very real.
Yeah.
As kind of a dissenting voice on the film, it's a weird thing for me to close with. But I weirdly feel like this would be a good movie to teach. Actually, in a good way, because in my experience, I found teaching movies that I like to be just like very exhausting for me, ultimately. If you're teaching something, you want to like it, but you also want to like be able to like look at it academically. And like I always remember one of my more stressful experiences with teaching a movie was when I teached Roma, which is a film I really like a lot, but a movie that makes me cry really badly. And when I taught it the last time, I had to leave the room because I was just like not emotionally prepared to like deal with that. And I was like, why did I assign this? Like, they could have watched it at home, but I watched it with my class and I just had to leave for like half an hour. But beyond the fact that Fabian will not make me cry, it also, I think, it's a movie that is doing so many interesting things. Like you can take it apart and like examine certain aspects of it. So like the aspect ratio or like the cinematography. It does also interesting things with sound. And I like sound in movies, so like I feel like it would be a good film to like examine or like teach or study, because it is ambitious, it's really thoughtful, it has a purpose. And I think ultimately you kind of want, because you don't want all movies that you watch to be the same, so I feel like I would recommend it even though I don't like it very much, just because it has like a clear sense of what it wants to be. And I feel like ultimately like we want that from movies.
I like it a lot more than you do, but I kind of know what you mean in the sense that I wouldn't say I have a strong emotional reaction to this film, and I'm not going to watch it 10 times, but I'm really glad that I saw it and talked about it. But I think, to your point, like something that Eskil Vogt, who is the co-writer of all of Joachim Trier's films, said to me is that he and Joachim Trier think that movies are too simple. And that if you're going to have somebody sit down and spend 2 hours with your film, that it should be full of ideas. And I think that Fabian definitely meets that challenge. I don't know that all of them work, but I think I'm glad that they're there and they're worth engaging with. I would absolutely recommend the film. I think it's a wild ride. Is it like my favorite movie? No, but I think it's a really interesting film, and I don't think there are enough of those.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, the amount of feature films that could have been a short film, just like, you know, a phone call that could have been an email. It's sort of like, oh, you had one idea, but you wanted to make a feature film? Cool. And it's really nice to see a film that's ambitious, that has more than one thing going on in it. And I didn't necessarily love the film, but I think it was, I mean, clearly it was an interesting topic for a podcast because we've talked about it for 90 minutes. It's that kind of film that I think you can engage with different parts of what it's doing, whether you felt sort of viscerally connected to it or not, because it is doing so many things. You've got to latch onto something.
And I guess in the comments you can tell us whether you think Tom Schilling is virile or not, or whether Luca Marinelli or Tom Schilling One Night Only, who is your choice?
Yes, and which one of them looks more like they were have a weak heart from the war.
I did want to give a brief shout out to Albert Shook, who I think is doing really wonderful work as Laboud.
Yeah, so he was, I first saw him in System Crasher.
Yeah.
A few years ago, which he was really, really good in.
And very different, I think, in that than in this film. So next week on the podcast, we will be back with a members-only bonus episode in which we discuss portraits of female artists. We did an episode on this 2 years ago?
Almost exactly 2 years ago.
Wow, okay. Where we talked about a lot of recent films that were in this mode, and now there's actually already quite a lot more films that fit into this canon, so we're going to be talking about more recent versions of that that have come out since 2020.
Do like The Souvenir Part 2, Bergman Island.
Summerland.
Mothering Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, other movies as well.
Worst Person in the World, lots of perhaps.
Them. Oh yeah, I guess that's one. Many movies.
If you want to listen to that earlier episode, it's more than 6 months old, so you have to become a member to do so. And also to listen to the new bonus episode. You can become a member at 7th-row.com/join, and you'll get access to our entire archive of podcasts, as well as our bi-weekly members-only bonus episodes and a bunch of other benefits. In 2 weeks, we will be back with another free episode, and this is one on a filmmaker we have spent a lot of time thinking about, Celine Sciamma, who... we wrote a book on her previous film, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which you can get at sciammabook.com. And we will be back talking about her new film, which also premiered at Berlin in competition last year, and that's Petite Maman. Andrew, where can people find you?
You can find me online at my column is called Real Encounters, R-E-E-L, at stabroeknews.com, S-T-A-B-R-O-E-K. And you can find my old tweets on Twitter at Departed Aviator. I haven't really tweeted much for the year, but if you want to, you know, dig into the annals of my mind, you are free to do so.
Orlo,
good to know.
Where can people find you?
You can find me at Orlamango on Twitter, also not particularly frequently tweeting, but tweeting at my work. And you can find me at my writing on 7th Row, and you can find me every week on this podcast, including the two episodes Alex just mentioned.
You can find me on Twitter at bwestcineast, bwestcineaste, and like Orla, you can also find my work on 7th Row and me on this podcast every week. You can find all of us on Twitter and Instagram at 7th Row, S-E-V-E-N-T-H-R-O-W. We would also love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at contact@7th-row.com, that's S-E-V-E-N-T-H-R-O-W.com. We would love to hear from you.
Yeah, we would really love to hear from you. Really curious if anyone's seen Fabienne and has thoughts, because like we said, it is a film that provokes many thoughts. And yeah, so write in about this episode or the podcast in general or any other episodes. You can contact us via our email, like Alex just said, but you can also reach us by reviewing us on iTunes. That has the added benefit of helping people find the podcast and like putting your review out there. Any correspondence we get, unless you tell us that you're not comfortable with it being shared, we'll read out on the podcast and discuss and celebrate, because it does make us very happy when we hear back from people who listen. And yeah, so rate and review, please. It really helps out.
Thanks for listening.